Hey, thanks. God bless. Please be seated. I want to thank Mike for the privilege of being a part of this group in preparation for this weekend. It's been real rewarding, not just in being able to have a sense of how these things fit together regarding these two books and the history leading up to these two books, but even more specifically, the practical application behind these books that you can see in our own lives. Certainly from what Mike covered yesterday, there's a lot that could be not just understood about God's character, but so much about what God not just would be to his children of Israel in the past, of how he'd restore them, how he would love them, how he was merciful to them, how he would promise things to them, and then watch over them to bring those promises to pass. Like he said yesterday in his opening, there's some things that do not change, and one of those things is God. And that has certainly been a reward of looking at this material. So thanks again, Mike. You know what? Like Mike said, there's going to be four teachings today. Two of them you're going to have to deal with me on. And the first one this morning is going to be regarding chronology. So everyone sees that chart in front of them, has been asking, how do you read this? How do you use this? What purpose is this? And we're going to get into this as to how that can be used. So it's certainly your reference. Feel free to take notes on that chart. It's yours to take home. Do what you want. If you can't read the font, then write it down. If you can't see something legibly on there, you know, certainly we had to make it small enough so it could fit on a piece of paper you could take home with. If you saw the one originally, the scale, it was like we needed two of these tables to fit it on. So, you know, we tried to work with something that would be able to be usable for you to take home with. I mean, what we're giving you on one side of that chart is like 200 years worth of information. So, you know, bear with us on that as well. But this morning we're going to be covering chronology. And, you know, does everybody know what chronology is? You know, chronology is really just the arrangements of events and the dates and order of events in order to see how they occur. And you'll notice how some things in the Word of God, like one gospel in particular, is written in chronological order. There's other things in the Word of God that aren't. You know, for example, the books of the Bible aren't necessarily in chronological order. If you read Genesis and then keep going all the way through, it's not just each book tacks on after the other one in like blocks. They overlap. I mean, that's revelation to some. I mean, that was when I heard that, it was like, wow. You know, this thing is much, much smaller than I thought it was, and it doesn't cover as big of a time span. But we're going to be looking at, specifically today, or this morning, the things leading up to Ezra and Nehemiah and the order of events there. But you've got to ask yourself, well, why is that important? Why does chronology matter? I thought we just wanted to know about Jesus Christ, or we just want to know, you know, the specific things that not just happened in order, but why do they happen? We want to know the heart behind it, right? Well, that's true, but let's just go to Haggai chapter 1, and I'll show you something. You know where Haggai is? No? Okay. There's an Old Testament, and in the Old Testament, it ends with Malachi. If you go back one book, it's Zechariah, and go back another book, it's Haggai. They call those prophets the minor prophets because they're small people. No, it's just these books, in comparison to the bigger, you know, the major prophets, those books are huge, like Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah. They're a little bit bigger. They call these the minor prophets. Haggai, chapter 1, verse 1. In the second year of Darius, the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai, the prophet, unto Zerubbabel. You see, right here, God's word records the second year of Darius, the king, the sixth month, the first day of the month. So one of the reasons why I think chronology is important is because God does. Because God went out of his way. He didn't just say there was this king that came and I was during his time. Or, you know, the words of the Lord came to this prophet. He says specifically month, day, year, the person who reigned. So one of the reasons why I think chronology is important is because God thinks it's important. Why would God have this type of information written down for us if he didn't want us to know specifically when this prophet showed up on the scene, what was going on in the background regarding this prophet, what this prophet had to deal with when he showed up? So I think chronology is extremely important because it provides us with the relationships and the events and the framework surrounding the people, the culture, the circumstances. And when we start understanding how some of the things in this, the Old Testament throughout the Word of God starts fitting together, you start seeing these incremental steps in this process that God is taking and the progress towards redemption a lot clearer, a lot deeper. It really does add some light to it that God doesn't just say some things, work with some people, and then wait and wait and wait and wait. I mean, he's still working. Even like, for example, like those 70 years, he said, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to wipe you like a dish, right? Remember that last night? But he kept working even in those 70 years. He didn't just take a vacation. He didn't say, you know, I'm done with you and then I'm going to come back for somebody new. And we're going to look at that this morning of how he still worked in those 70 years. So learning chronology helps alleviate some certain strains on verses. But like I said, our scope today is just going to be leading up to Ezra and Nehemiah. If you've known anything about the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and read those previously to this weekend or have just know anything on the surface regarding them, there's kind of four blocks of time, if you will, in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. The first six chapters of Ezra cover really one man who kind of ruled over them, which was Zerubbabel. He was a governor. And that first six chapters of Ezra has to do with rebuilding the temple, okay? Ezra 7 through 10 has to do with Ezra coming back. So although the book's called Ezra, Ezra doesn't even show up till the seventh chapter. But regardless, those last chapters of that book have to do with Ezra coming back to beautify the temple and doing certain things after the temple was already established. And that has to do with Ezra. The book of Nehemiah, okay, that's the third kind of block of time. The book of Nehemiah has to do with Nehemiah building the wall. And Nehemiah does quite a bit of things in conjunction with rebuilding the wall, which this evening Josh is going to get into. And then this fourth block of time is the book of Esther, which is really outside of our scope for this weekend. But that's a fourth block, and you can read about Esther marrying a king. And there's some things about Mordecai having to do with Haman. So there's four blocks, Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, okay? These blocks could be laid out, you know, if this was an order, right after another. So the wall, or the temple, the wall, Ezra, Esther. So they could just be in order, or they could be stacked, or they could, you know, how do these four blocks overlap on top of another? And that's really one of the great debates, because you could read the book of Ezra and Nehemiah together, and it's not necessarily clear just from reading what came first. And the reason is there have been, if you read the King James, obviously if you just read the King James, Ezra comes before Nehemiah, and that's what some has said, that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, a lot of people think, this is just a side note, by the way, that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah were one book originally, and there's a lot of reasons for that. That one is it's in the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament. It was one book. It was, and they called it First and Second Ezra. It really didn't appear to be split into two books until like later on after that. So some of them just say it's obviously the temple came first, then the wall. It's just obvious because that's the way it comes in the King James. But there are some, like Bollinger, who says the walls came first and then the temple. So the book of Nehemiah is the one that really would come first in chronology. And he's got reasons for that. We're not going to get into all those reasons or debate those reasons, but I'm just giving you alternatives for what's there so that, you know, as we get into it, you're going to be able to see, you know, one, here's our proposed order, just the best that at this point in time, can understand that order. But there are alternatives out there that people have proposed, and we not necessarily would want to take heed to all those things, but we want to be for sure when we read the scriptures and be confident that we understand, okay, this is what it's communicating. The real conventional order that the most people agree on, because a lot of people see Bollinger's proposal and they think it's a little extreme. You know, some of his points that he brings out are hard to prove. But the real conventional one is that the temple comes first, the temple's completed, And then Ezra comes back to beautify it like 50 years later. And then the walls are built about 13 years after Ezra comes back. So that's the course of when Cyrus gives his proclamation that Mike read last night about the Jews being released to go back to Jerusalem, to the end of the book of Nehemiah is like 110, 120 years. That's the conventional order, and that's what most people agree on. Oh, by the way, this morning, it's going to be some, if you stick with me, it's going to be profitable. So we're going to be covering a little bit of more dry material, but if you do stick with me, a lot of this is going to make sense, and you'll understand why. And nevertheless, our proposed order, I do think that the temple came first, then the walls, but a much more shorter, condensed version of that. And let's just go to Jeremiah 25. In Jeremiah 25, verse 10. Well, we'll start in verse 8. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, because you have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, said the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof and against all these nations round about, and will utterly destroy them and make them astonishment and a hissing and perpetual desolations. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness and the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride and the sound of the millstones and the light of the candle. And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, saith the Lord, for their iniquity in the land of the Chaldeans will make it a perpetual desolation. So you see here that Jeremiah, like Mike covered last night, gave a prophecy from words of the Lord regarding 70 years. 70 years that this nation of Babylon was going to come and destroy them, and that the nations would serve this king for 70 years. It said in verse 12, it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished, I'll punish the king of Babylon. And that nation, saith the Lord, for their iniquity. So it wasn't that God just liked Babylon. It was God was being just to his people and was using this other Gentile nation to fulfill his purposes and filling out his justice, which is pretty interesting. But God promises 70 years, and then he's going to come visit them. He promises 70 years, these people are going to serve him. And certainly Mike covered the span of that 70 years that they did get destroyed. There was three deportations, though. You know, the first one was in Daniel 1 that we read about last night, that the first one, when Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem for the first time, Daniel got taken, okay? That was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. So let's just talk about this chart for a second, shall we? Everyone get your chart out. Turn to the side that says Assyrian and Babylonian captivity. I'm going to show you how to use this, and then you can do what you want with it and use it any other purpose you want. And you can make planes, or you could do what you want with it, but this is how we intended it to be used. And the left side of the chart has the kings. You'll see at the very top says Assyrian rulers, and then there's four of those listed. And then under each of those kings, there's numbers. Those numbers represent the years BC that those kings ruled. Under that, you've got the Babylonian rulers. So Assyrian conquered Israel, and then eventually Babylon came in and conquered Assyria. And then you've got Babylonian rulers all the way from, you're going to have to forgive me for some of these names. These are kind of hard. Nabopolassar, all the way down to the bottom, Darius, the Mede, and Cyrus. So you've got those kings. And then this second portion right in the middle of your chart right here is the Judah kings. So these overlap in Judah. You've got kings over the people of Judah who are ruling and reigning the Jews at the same time the Babylonians or the Assyrians are reigning. And you've got Hezekiah at the top that goes all the way down to Zedekiah. And you'll notice that in between there's Manasseh, Amon, Josiah, Jehoaz, Joachim, Jehoiachin, and then Zedekiah. So we covered some of those last night. And then on the bottom, this third portion, you've got books of the Bible, you know, or prophets. So Isaiah, Hosea, Micah, those individuals are known to have prophesied at the time of the Assyrian captivity, the Assyrian rule. Then you've got Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. They really start at the end of the Assyrian, the beginning of the Babylonian conquest. And then Zephaniah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel are some of the major prophets that have to do with the time of the Babylonians during Nebuchadnezzar's time and others. So that's what's going on with there's all these people over the course of this 200 years. And then you've got on these charts here, these lines represent years. Okay, so if you've got 15 of these different little blocks, that's going to stand for 15 years. The challenge is that in order to get 200, 250 years to fit on this piece of paper, we had to like take out some portions of time that may not, it's not necessarily they're insignificant. It's just there's nothing that we wanted to cover this weekend that happened in those times. So you'll notice there's some vertical lines that are dashed. Those vertical dashed lines stand for, you know, time gaps that if you expanded the chart to be as long as two tables, you know, it would be that big. But we took some of those things out to get it down to this 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. So that's what those vertical lines are. And then there's some text on here. You'll notice that underneath each of those bars, there is the name of the king it stands for, because it could get a little confusing if you're trying to look for Labish Marduk. And where does he go? And it's all the way over on the right side, and you can't line it up. So thankfully, somebody put the text of that name right next to that box so you would understand that. Also, there's notes on here in like a 45-degree angle on these bars as well. And those stand for just some of the things that Mike wanted to bring to your attention last night during his teaching. So for example, the sixth year of Hezekiah, what happened in the sixth year of Hezekiah? You go to Hezekiah, you look for number six, and it says Israel, 10 northern tribes, goes into exile during the sixth year. So that's when the Assyrians conquered the 10 northern tribes. You know, it's the same thing for like what happened during Jehoiachin's time period. What happened then? Jehoiachin, you go, and it says king. The king and 10,000 were taken captive, and Ezekiel taken captive. So it's just a little bit of notes. You can add as many notes as you want to this, okay? You can put what you think is important on here. This is just things that we thought would be, and we didn't want to add too much detail, so obviously it's already small enough, so you know, please forgive us for that. But we wanted to at least give something that would show you how these bars at the very least overlap, that you could see during Nebuchadnezzar's time. Nebuchadnezzar reigns for like 43 years, but there's three kings in Judah, and there's three prophets at least that show up during his time with this Babylonian. So you understand that these volumes of these books are much more condensed than just a big scale. So that's how to use the chart. The other side is the same thing. If you go to the other side, instead of covering 200 years from the Assyrian captivity all the way through to Cyrus's edict, the other side is the Ezra and Nehemiah chronology that we're going to cover this morning. And this one is set up the same way with Persian kings, and there are four Persian kings that history has really denoted, first being Cyrus, the second is Cambyses, the third is Semerdis, and the fourth is Darius. And then you've got the books of the Bible that we're going to cover, those four blocks of time I mentioned. One's Ezra, chapters 1 through 6 with Zerubbabel. The second one's Ezra, 7 through 10, that has to do with Ezra beautifying the temple. Then you've got Esther and then Nehemiah with the wall building. And then there's three prophets that prophesied during those times. One is Haggai, the other is Zechariah, and then the third is Malachi. And Malachi, there's some things I think Josh is going to get into and some details regarding Malachi, but it's not explicitly clear whether or not Malachi fits into this at the very end, But there's so many relationships between the end of Nehemiah 13 and Malachi that it appears as if they do. So we've got them there just for your benefit. And that's the chart. Hope that helps a little bit. So we're going to go back to what we were talking about previously. So hopefully that big tangent didn't totally distract you. But there was a 70-year promise, remember? In Jeremiah. 70 years. 70 years, the king of Babylon, the Babylonians, were going to pretty much reign. And that indeed happened. Nebuchadnezzar came. Daniel was taken in the first year. And then approximately 8 years later, Nebuchadnezzar came again and deported more people. And then about 11 years after that, he came again and deported more people in that final deportation. So Nebuchadnezzar came three times to Jerusalem to deport Jews. And what's interesting, if you read those records, the first time he deports people, just the poor are left. He only leaves the poor. The second time he comes, he only leaves the poor as well. So it's the poor of the poor that's left. And the second time he takes some of the temple vessels as well with him. The third time he comes and he just burns everything. He burns the temple, he burns homes, he burns crops and fields, he leaves nothing. And he takes the best of the people to the capital, to the people who were the brightest, the most skilled, the strongest. He takes those back to his capital for his purposes to train up to use. So you've got three deportations, and a lot of people say that that first deportation, 70 years after that, from that first one until Cyrus's edict, was 70 years. That when Cyrus finally gave his edict, that was the fulfillment of that 70 years prophecy. And there are some other alternatives as to what's the fulfillment of this 70 years. First of all, you've got to read in the text where it says that these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. It also says he's going to come and punish that king after 70 years. So some of the other alternatives are the burning of the temple, which was in the 19th year of the king of Babylon, until the completion of the temple was 70 years. But the promise is that he's going to punish the king after 70 years, right? So you're hard to say that could be the fulfillment, right? So there's other alternatives for what people think the fulfillment of that 70-year span is. But I think, based upon the text, it's got to be this edict made by Cyrus is that fulfillment. So Daniel was taken in that first year by Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel ends up back at the capital. He interprets the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, and he gets promoted and puts in charge for interpreting that dream. And also Daniel, when he got taken captive, went with some individuals as well from Judah, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And you can read about them in the third chapter of Daniel, of how Nebuchadnezzar made this huge idol and asked everyone to bow down and worship this big statue, that glorified him. And these three men said, no, we're not going to bow down. And they didn't. So Nebuchadnezzar so graciously gave them a reward by throwing them into a burning fiery furnace. And they came out not even smelling like smoke. And so Nebuchadnezzar rewarded them by granting them authority and privileges and promoting them as well. So it's interesting. This is after the captivity, and yet there's still people who are standing for God. God is still working. God hasn't departed. Like I said, he's not taking a vacation. He's still there, even during this captivity. He hasn't just forgotten his people, which is so overwhelming to me at times in reading this, that God is so good that he still loves his people that much. I mean, just like the thing that Mike read last night regarding how long Jeremiah spoke until God said, I've had enough. I mean, 23 years is a long time. So you've got Daniel, who's at this capital with the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the first Babylonian king. After him, if you look at your chart, there was a few more that followed him. He was the longest in reign, about 43 years. There was this man named Evil Merodach who reigned after him. And then there was Nergal-Sharezer, and then Labish-Marduk, Nabonius, Belshazzar, and then finally Darius the Mede. Now, these kings aren't... The only one that I know that is spoken about, the Babylonian kings, in the Word of God is Evil Merodach, and that's how 2 Kings closes out. 2 Kings closes out with releasing Jehoiachin. from prison. So remember that second deportation occurred during his reign in the eighth year of Nebuchadnezzar, and he got taken captive and put in jail, and then this evil Murdoch was gracious to him and let him go out of jail. That was really how the book of 2 Kings closes. But what Daniel talks about in the book of Daniel is let's go to Daniel chapter 5. What's interesting is Nebuchadnezzar promotes Daniel, and then you've got these new kings that, you know, that person probably dies and another person comes up in his stead, either his son or somebody else that rules Babylon. And somehow Daniel is still known and still around, is still alive, still at the capital. And something happens in Daniel chapter 5. You've got this man named Belshazzar, who is the son of Nabonidus, and he was somebody who ruled in conjunction with his father. So that's why you've got this overlap at the very end on your chart that he wasn't his own. He didn't have his sole reign. He ruled in conjunction with somebody else. Nevertheless, Daniel 5 talks about how Belshazzar, in verse 1, the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and the silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines might drink therein. So remember, Nebuchadnezzar came and conquered Jerusalem, took the vessels, took them back to his own place, and had them somewhere in keeping in the storage. And then this king threw a feast. And this king wanted to entertain his guests, apparently, in a fashion where he wanted to go get these temple vessels that were gold and silver. And one of the reasons why I think that it talks about the quality of those vessels is because they were probably of a very good quality. But he did it. And it says in verse 3, then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and the concubines drank there in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. This is really, really bad. It's if you know anything, like Mike shared, what the temple was for. The temple was where God said he would place his name. The temple was where the worship and service of God was to be had. That was really where man could meet with God. God had said the temple was a place where he would put his eyes and his heart perpetually. He said that his glory was going to be there. And these vessels that only a certain group of the children of Israel were allowed to do service within certain portions of this temple. And certainly the vessels were only allowed to be touched, let alone seen, by a certain group, a small portion, a percentage. And they were supposed to be holy. They were supposed to be set apart and dedicated for the sole purpose of worship to God and for his dedication. And these things that were holy and set apart, you've got a Gentile king not only using them, but defiling them at the same time by drinking out of it and praising gods of gold, worshiping idols as he's using these vessels. I mean, it makes you almost weep to see how low the stuff that used to be gods had gone. And they're being defiled here. But God's not ignorant, and God's not closed, you know, his eyes aren't closed. He's definitely aware. In verse 5, and the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the pilaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. So there's a handwriting on the wall that happens after this. So they're having probably a merry time. They're jesting. Maybe they're trying to show that how their gods were authority over
this one true God that they had heard about in Israel. You know, praising gods of gold, it must be bigger and better than the God of Israel. So they see some writing on the wall, and this guy evidently gets kind of scared. And nevertheless, the queen of the king here knows about Daniel, who interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream like 50-some years ago. And this queen mentions to the king, I know this person with a good spirit in him who knows how to interpret dreams. Why don't we bring him in to see if he can interpret this writing that's on the wall? So they do. And then if you go down at the end of the chapter, in verse 24, then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Ushpharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene. So there was words on the wall, and he's saying, Daniel shows up to the king. He's going to start interpreting these things. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and are found wanting. Persis, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. What I think is interesting is he shows up, they're having a feast, some sort of party, they defile the temple vessels, they see some writing on the wall, get scared, invite this man in. This man gives them and said, you're going to get destroyed and these other nations are going to conquer you. And you're found in the balance wanting and lacking. Here's a robe, and they reward him. I don't understand the politics going on. It's like you tell me something that's bad, and they say, thanks for your service. And not only that, but you get promoted. I don't quite get it fully, but I just, God's good. That's all I can see from this is God's still working. So Belshazzar gets the interpretation, and then look what happens in verse 30. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And verse 31, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So Belshazzar ends up dying. He gets killed that night. So he defiled the temple vessels, and then he dies immediately. So pretty serious matter, and that's kind of what would have happened if the temple had still stood. If you had defiled it in that way, you would have died. But what's interesting is the people or the nation of Israel aren't the one defending God. God's doing that all on his own. He's taking care of his own, and he's taking care of his purposes pretty well without the help of his people. And so Belshazzar dies, and this when Belshazzar dies, it said it was at night. So a lot of people say that the killing of Belshazzar was the sack of Babylon. So Babylonian had reigned, and they had conquered Israel, and they were the ruling power in the region for such a long time. And then that night, from this text, they say that was when Babylon ended. Babylon was pretty much no more, and Darius the Mede was somebody who took over. Now, from history, there's no one called Darius the Mede. So Darius has to be a title, okay? So the question comes up, if, for example, like king is a title, Caesar is a title, Czar is a title, Sultan is a title, Dustin is not a title. Dustin is my name, but I'm not King Dustin. So there could be a man named Darius, but a lot of people have suggested that Darius is a title. And it could be the Median. There is a Persian word now, so there's a Persian word now called Daria, which means king. So it just could have been the Median king came. The king from Media came. And there's also individuals who say that if you translate this old Persian word Darius into English, it could mean restrainer or commander. So it would have been the Median commander or the Median restrainer. And this Darius the Mede is not necessarily known who it is, but he comes in and he conquers Babylon, and he his army kills Belshazzar. And remember, right after Daniel interpreted the writing, he got promoted. But then the person who promoted him died. Verse 1 of chapter 6, and it pleased Darius, who just now takes over, to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. So he had the whole kingdom, and he starts going to work setting people over these different provinces, 120 of them. In verse 2, and over these three presidents. So he had three people that were over 120. And then look at this, of whom Daniel was first, and that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. I think that's wonderful. These people are supposed to be in captivity, and look what's going on. I mean, this reminds you of like Joseph, right? You know, Joseph gets sold to slavery and then rises up. Then he goes to jail and he gets rise up, and then he gets in the Pharaoh's house and he rises up. And it wasn't because he just set out to be a dreamer, and you know, he was really a political guy who knew how to connect and was so, you know, a great person who was planning to achieve high ends. It was all God. It was God working. And I think it's no less the same with this man, Daniel. And the whole reason I'm going through this is because of what one of the where Mike closed out is later on. You've got this with Daniel's prayer regarding how he finally understood from the books the number of years that Jeremiah prophesied. So you've got this Darius the Mede, and then after Darius the Mede, some people have said Darius the Mede could be Cyrus, okay? Darius the Mede was 62 years old when he started to reign. It could be Cyrus. Some people have said it's this Darius the Mede could have been the king of the Medians, who Cyrus had conquered 12 years previously. So there was a king in a different region who Cyrus came and conquered, and then Cyrus was in charge of that, but he was still kind of ruling that land for Cyrus as a subjugate. And then, or it could have been this Darius the Mede could have been the commander of Cyrus's army. Regardless who you think it is, there's this Darius the Mede. And Darius the Mede is the guy that's talked about in Daniel 6 with Daniel in the lion's den. Darius the Mede is, he's just somebody who bridges a gap between the end of Babylon and Cyrus. But we're going to go to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel 9. And verse 1, in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years, whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. So Daniel got taken captive, and then in that first year of Nebuchadnezzar. So Daniel was in Babylon for 70 years, and so Daniel could have been a young man when he was taken. He had seen Jerusalem at one point in time. He had seen the existence of the temple. He had seen the institutions of God performed. He got taken captive. And then ever since then, he was in Babylon until this happens in the first year of Darius, Darius the Mede. So 70 years later, 68 years later, he reads these words that Jeremiah had spoken about. So Jeremiah had given these words while he had already left. So there's no indication that Daniel had been exposed to these words previously. And when he sees them, when he hears about these 70 years that God had promised of desolation, but then he would come and visit them again. Look what verse 3 says, and I set my face on the Lord God to seek by prayer. You know, he doesn't just... I think this is wonderful, and there are some... This is well worth your study if you ever want to look at something in detail regarding the heart and the nature of prayer. This chapter in particular is one of those, but we don't really have time to get into all the details regarding this prayer, but I want to take you down to, let's go to verse 16 O Lord, according to all thy righteousness, I beseech thee, let thy anger and thy fury be turned away from thy city Jerusalem, thy holy mountain, because of our sins, and for the iniquities of our father Jerusalem, and thy people are become a reproach to all that are about us. Now therefore, O our God, hear the prayer of thy servant and his supplications, and cause thy face to shine upon thy sanctuary that is desolate for thy Lord's sake. O my God, incline thy ear and hear, open thy eyes and behold our desolations, and the city which is called by thy name. For we do not present our supplications before thee for our righteousness, but for thy great mercies. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, hearken and do. Defer not. For thy own sake, O my God, for thy people and thy people are called by thy name. I can only envision how low he is, and how much humility this is. O Lord, I beseech you, I ask. Be merciful to us. I mean, he's pouring his heart out. In verse 20, and while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people, I love how he includes himself in that. He doesn't just say my forefathers, but my sin and the sin of my people. Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of God. Yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. So he got an answer pretty quickly. And verse 22, and he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth. And I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider in the vision. So this man, or this angel, Gabriel, shows up by God. And pretty much at the very beginning of Daniel's prayer, God sent this angel to him to give him an answer, to give him skill and understanding specifically regarding something. And he gives him a vision. And this vision is, in verse 24, this open message in verse 24, 70 weeks are determined upon your people and upon your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision of prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Interesting here, okay? It seems cryptic, but if you know anything about what God had promised the children of Israel originally from the very beginning, you would understand what he's getting at. There's going to be 70 weeks, though, he says. 70 weeks, okay? 70 weeks for end of transgression, reconciliation, end of iniquity, everlasting righteousness, anointing the holy. What do you think that's talking about, those things? Jesus Christ, exactly. That there's going to be 70 weeks until everlasting righteousness is brought in. So from the time Daniel gets this prophecy, if you go 70 weeks, everlasting righteousness is not brought in. So what people understand is, and what I think is a Hebrew idiom, It's weeks of years. So it's 70 weeks of years. And there would be a week of a year is 7 years. So it's 70 times 7. So that would be 490 years. So what's interesting is Daniel starts praying regarding this captivity. And he says, he reads Jeremiah and he starts pouring out his soul to God regarding the words he just read from Jeremiah. And says, God, I want you to restore us. I want you to bring us back for your mercies. And I know you're righteous. I know you love your people. You haven't departed. You said after 70 years, and he says, defer not. And God says, okay, he sends an angel. An angel shows up. I heard your prayer, and I came immediately. And by the way, in 490 years, the one Messiah that everyone's been looking for in this nation, the one that you have foreshadowed with your sacrifices in this temple originally, is going to show up on the scene and bring in all the things I promised you from the beginning. The everlasting righteousness, iniquity, and sins are going to be done away with forever. That's a pretty cool answer, isn't it? He's in captivity. He's in captivity. He just wants to get back to Jerusalem. And God shows up and gives him more than that. Much more than that. He says 70 weeks are going to happen. In verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks. and 62 weeks. So from the going forth of the commandment to who? The Messiah, the Prince. Okay, so obviously the previous verse regarding the 7 weeks had to do with the Messiah. But there's going to be 7 weeks and then 62. 62 is 62. Okay, so 7 plus 62 is 69. Correct. So from the going forth of the commandment to the Messiah is going to be 69 weeks of years. 62 times 7. I'm testing you here really hard. 62 times 7 is like 432. Something like that. Sure. Okay, so 483. Right. So 69 times 7 is 483 years. What I think is interesting is that he gives him two time periods, okay? He says 70 weeks is going to complete it, all of it, 70 weeks of years. That's 490 years. But he also says from the going forth of the commandment to the Messiah, just to the Messiah is going to be 69 weeks of years, 483 years. So what we're going to, and then it goes on, let's see, in verse, I'll read 25 again. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the prince shall be 7 weeks and the 62 weeks, the street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. So it's definitely talking about the restoration of Jerusalem itself. And in verse 26, and after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself and the people of the prince. Of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be a flood unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause a sacrifice of the oblation of season, for the overspreading of abomination shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So what's interesting, you've got 7, 62, and 1 equals 70 total. But that one last week really is like Revelation time period. You've got this, it's going to be 69 until he's cut off, but you're going to have 7 weeks still. So there's an increment of 7 weeks of years, or 49 years until from the going forth of the commandment to the restoring of the city. And that's where I think this condensed chronology has to come into play, that from the going forth of Cyrus's edict to the end of not just when the temple's erected, but the end of the cities being built and the end of the restoration of the children of Israel, not just to the location, but back to the covenant and its full potential, its full, you know, full availability happens, has to be 49 years. And indeed it is, but we'll look at that. So Daniel gets this vision, he gets an answer. I love it that Daniel gets this answer. And this answer not just addresses his immediate concern regarding the restoration of the children of Israel to the place, but it also addresses, man, the Messiah is coming, and this hope regarding specific years, like 483 years to the Messiah, like to the date. Pretty cool. So let's go to Ezra chapter 1. So Daniel keeps living a little bit longer, and mind you, that was the first year of Darius the Mede. Daniel's still alive even during Cyrus's reign. If you keep reading the book of Daniel, you can read how Daniel stood by and strengthened Cyrus in his third year. So whatever transition happened between Darius the Mede and Cyrus, Daniel's still alive, and he's still at the capital of Babylon. And he's still there, and he's still got some sort of role and authority, and he's still got the ear of the king. But nevertheless, he got that answer, and that's exactly what happens here is in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And who is there among you of all his people, His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord, God of Israel. He is the God which is at Jerusalem. So this man Cyrus shows up on the scene and gives an edict and finally releases all the children of Israel from the Babylonian captivity. So Cyrus takes over. He conquers the Babylonians. He gives this open proclamation. The children get to go. Daniel's alive. Daniel got to see that answer. He got to see that. And what's interesting is you read this, and it said God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, and he's talking about, you know, things that like I said, Daniel had the ear of the king. So Daniel may have been the one to help him draft this. Daniel may have been right there next to him, giving him, you know, counsel to help word this particularly. Daniel may have showed him Jeremiah. You know, Daniel read it. Daniel was right there. He may have went to the king and showed him how, oh, by the way, this God of heaven has foretold of you specifically. What's interesting is that in Jeremiah, it's just 70 years, right? There's other prophecies. If you go to Isaiah chapter 44, Isaiah 44, they say explicitly, not just after 70 years, there's going to be release, or after 70 years, God's going to come to you and let you go free. But it explicitly says in the Old Testament, Cyrus is going to do this. Which, man, I imagine that. In chapter 44, verse 28, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. In verse 1 of chapter 45, thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. And go down to verse 13. I have raised him up in righteousness and will direct all his ways. He shall build my city, and he shall let go my captives, not for price nor reward, saith the Lord of hosts. What's so fascinating is that Isaiah prophesied during the Assyrian captivity 100 years before Cyrus even shows up on the scene, and God says, this guy is going to do it. This guy, the children of Israel should have known, and Daniel could have read this or known about this, and he could have shown Cyrus these same words, which I think is amazing. So let's go back to Ezra. Go back to Ezra chapter 1. So Daniel was certainly around. Daniel could have shown these prophecies. Cyrus was certainly the man who was going to do it, and God had foretold that 100 years previously. Daniel had, remember, was probably pretty aged at this point in time. He was originally taken captive and then was there for the 70 years. So Daniel was probably around 80 to 90 at this point in time. And you know, Josh has done the research to see that the geology between where Babylon is and the Jerusalem is anywhere between 700 to 1,000 miles. So for a man of that age to travel that distance may have been a little taxing. So one of the reasons you don't read about it in some of the lists that are given in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah of Daniel going back. You know, after the book of Daniel, he doesn't come up. He may have died. And I, regardless of him ever actually seeing the restoration itself, of being able to see the land he went back to, he had an answer. He saw the edict. He heard the edict. And he got a vision regarding the Messiah to come. I think that's worth more than seeing land, you know. I think that's much, much more. He got his answer for sure. So Cyrus shows up on the scene. And the first year of Cyrus is a king who gives this edict and this release. I had mentioned previously, but if you look at your chart of Ezra and Nehemiah, after Cyrus rules for about 8 to 9 years. After him rules another king, Cambyses. After him rules this king, Samertus, and Samertus rules for about 7 months. And then after that king rules Darius. Darius rules for about 36 years. All right, so this is the order. Just for your understanding, after Darius, there's a king of Persia called Xerxes, And after Xerxes, there's a king called Artaxerxes. Okay? What makes understanding the chronology we're going to be looking at in these books a little challenging is like what I had mentioned regarding Darius. Darius is a title, right? But Darius was also a man who showed up later. Okay, so there was a man named Darius. There's also a title of Darius, Darius the Restrainer. There, in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you'll see the word Artaxerxes, the king Artaxerxes. So there was a Persian king called Artaxerxes, but Artaxerxes could also be a title. At least that's what a lot of people have suggested. Artaxerxes could be a title. And I don't know the translation of this specifically. People have put forth some really interesting things that Artaxerxes, if you take this Persian word and translate it to English, means like fervent to spoil. That Artaxerxes, the title means this fervent to spoil. Or some people have said it means a great warrior. Or one who silences, or it just could be who rules through truth. So I don't know the translation on it. You know, people disagree. Regardless, the one thing I want you to understand is it could be a title. So the other thing is that just like Caesar or King or Pharaoh, the title, there's another title, Ahasuerus. You'll see that as well. Where these come up, like if you read Ezra, there's four kings that come up. Cyrus, Darius, Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes. If you read the book of Ezra, you'll see all four of those kings that come up. In Nehemiah, you'll just see Artaxerxes. In Esther, you'll just see Ahasuerus. So you don't see Darius come up in any of them. You don't see that, or at least in Nehemiah and Esther. So you've got to start asking yourself, okay, are these titles, are these men? How do you put these overlaps together? So we're just going to go through some verses, and I'll show you how some of these things fit together because God gives the year, the month, the person who is reigning in order for us to put this, to understand this a little bit better. Go to Ezra chapter 3, verse 1. In verse 1 of chapter 3, and when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. So, and then, this, in the first year, in the first month of Darius, or of Cyrus, that edict was made, the children of Israel left. They took heed to it, they left, and they went back to Jerusalem. And then it says here, and the seventh month, they were come. The people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. So they originally went back to their individual cities around Jerusalem. So you'll know, if you know anything about the Old Testament, that God had given the children of Israel's forefathers land. So each father had a portion of land in this nation. And then yet there was one city where the temple was located. So they would gather together during certain types of feasts as God required in the law. But they went to their cities originally of where their forefathers had known based on genealogy. They gathered together in the seventh month. So it took about 6 months to get back eventually to Jerusalem. You know, it's a 900-mile trip. You know, it's understandable. So they get there. They gathered as one man. And you see in verse 2, then stood up Joshua, the son of Josach and his brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and builded the altar. So they get there, and pretty quickly you see that the two individuals that are in charge are Joshua and Zerubbabel. So Joshua happens to be a descendant from the high priest, if you trace back his heritage all the way back to the high priest. Zerubbabel happens to be somebody who's a descendant from the kings of Judah. He was, I think, the grandson of Jehoiachin, I believe. But he traced that back. These two men are in charge pretty quickly. So that happens in the seventh month. And then in verse 8, now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Josiah, and the remnant of their brethren, and the priests and the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. So this is in the second year of their coming. and it's in the second month, okay? It's in the second year of the second month. So they show up in Jerusalem in the first year on the seventh month. Then about 7 months later, they start setting forward the work. So somewhere, why did it take so long for them to start setting forward the work? Probably they were gathering resources. You know, not only did Cyrus release them, Cyrus also gave them grants to go get resources from the surrounding nations around them. And so they probably were spending some time gathering resources. Nevertheless, they get there and they start doing this. You know, they start rebuilding the foundation. They ended up in verse 10, and when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets and Levites, and they started singing praises. So sometime in that second year, the foundation was laid, and it was laid, the foundation was finished, and they started praising God. Now, after that, in chapter 4 of Ezra, you got in verse 4, then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building. So they kept building, okay? And eventually, the people that were already there started frustrating them. In verse 5, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even unto the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So they frustrated their plans from the initial get-going of that rebuilding and that work all the way to Darius. If you look at your chart, the first year of Cyrus all the way to Darius is about 15 to 16 years of frustration, right? It was perpetual. They kept doing it. They kept frustrating their purposes. They weakened the hands of Judah. So this next section in chapter 4 is going to cover kind of that span between Cyrus and Darius. There's a couple kings that happen in between, and that's what this section talks about in verse 6. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him, unto the king, an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. So there's this king Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus could be a title. Ahasuerus, I think, is a title for Cambyses, which is the king that ruled in between Cyrus and Darius. And the people of the land wrote a letter to that king. You know, they probably complaining and wanting to get them to stop. And then in verse 7, and then in the days of Artaxerxes, wrote Bishalom and some other people and the rest of their companions unto Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And the writing of the letter was written in the Syrian tongue and interpreted in the Syrian tongue. So it goes from that king to a different king, Artaxerxes, okay? And there are a couple possibilities as to who this Artaxerxes could be. Artaxerxes could, like I said, certainly I think it's a title, but it could be the same king that was just mentioned in verse 6, Ahasuerus, which was a title of Cambyses. It could be this other king, Samertus, who only ruled shortly. Some people have said that in order for this short-lived rule of this king Samertus, you'd be hard-pressed to call him a title that was of the nature of Artaxerxes, just because of how weak he was. For him to be called a great warrior would be hard. What also was interesting is that you go through here in this chapter, there's some references to the plurality. It talks about kings reigning at this time for Persia, like not just one, but there was two people. If you know anything about the history of this Samertus king, there were brothers on the throne at this time. So I don't know who this Artaxerxes is referring to specifically. All I know, it's a transition to Darius, and that this frustration continued to occur for a long time. Even so much to the point where during this, whoever this Artaxerxes is, in verse 24 of chapter 4, then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So they stopped it sometime during the reign of Artaxerxes, whoever he was, and it ceased until the reign of Darius. So they started building the temple. They finally got back to this glorious estate. They put forward the work. They finished the foundation, and then they get oppressed, And so much so where not only do they stop, but they stop because they were by force. And so the temple stopped for about 2 to 8 years until in verse 5 or verse 1 of chapter 5, then the prophets Haggai, the prophet, and the Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Jerusalem in the name of God of Israel, even unto them. So hold your hand here, and let's go to Haggai again real quick. I want to show you something. Haggai, third book back from the end of the Old Testament. We're going to take a break pretty soon, just to let you know. Just hang in there with a little bit longer, and I want to show you how specifically that 7 weeks of years, I think, is fulfilled from the Edict of Cyrus to the end of this section we're looking at regarding Ezra and Nehemiah. So just a little bit longer, but in Haggai chapter 1, so the work had ceased on the temple for anywhere between 2 to 8 years, and then prophets show up. And verse 1 of chapter 1 of Haggai, in the second year of Darius, the king, in the 6th month and the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai, the prophet, unto who? Zerubbabel. So Zerubbabel, who was pretty much in charge, the governor, this prophet shows up in the 2nd year of Darius, the 2nd year. So he prophesies in the 2nd year of Darius. So we know that. That's pretty concrete, right? Go back to Ezra. What ends up happening is, if you look in chapter 5 of Ezra, in verse 2, then rose up Zerubbabel after the prophecy. So these prophets speak. What's so cool is that Haggai speaks in the 6th month. Haggai speaks in the 7th month. Zechariah speaks in the 11th month. And also the 8th month as well. So you've got this like 5-month span of these prophets giving words, and you can read about these words. And the words of the Lord show up, and then the next verse is, then rose up Zerubbabel. So words come, and then rising up occurs. And that's a really, really big theme in these books that we'll see more and more when we get into some of the details in our second session and also later on with Josh. So they start rebuilding, and they ended up finishing it in verse 15 of chapter 6. And the house was finished on the 3rd day of the month Adar, which is in the 6th year of the reign of Darius the king. So the prophets come back and speak on the 2nd year. It's finished in the 2nd year. And it takes them about four and a half years to finally finish this from the time that they started rebuilding again. But it's still during the time of that king Darius. And They finish it. I mean, this is like 20-some years in the making. They finally completed it. But they do. Then in verse, they ended up keeping the Passover right after that. And verse 1 of chapter 7, so right after the temple was completed, they kept the Passover. And then in verse 1 of chapter 7, now after these things in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra shows up. Ezra, you know, comes to the scene. So this is the first time we get to hear about Ezra. And what's interesting is that Darius is not mentioned throughout the rest of this book. He completely goes. And verse 8 of Ezra 7, and he came to Jerusalem in the 5th month, which was in the 7th year of the king. And upon the 1st day of the 1st month began he to go up from Babylon, and on the 1st day of the 5th month came he to Jerusalem. So he leaves in the 1st month of the 7th year. This is where people take this break between chapter 6 and chapter 7 and say, this Artaxerxes has to be the Artaxerxes of history. So Ezra goes in the 7th year of this king, of Artaxerxes, way in the future. So the temple's finished, and then he shows up like 50-some years later. I wonder, I'm proposing this, Artaxerxes is just a title. They finished the temple in the 6th year, in the 12th month, and in the 1st month of the 7th year, Ezra goes back to beautify it. You know, and it's just a transition. So why go from Darius to Artaxerxes? I think one of the reasons could be is Darius was a king, and as kings are known to do, they conquer. So he may have gathered more, and the title is changed because he conquered more lands and just became a great king, you know, the Artaxerxes. Nevertheless, Ezra goes back in the seventh year. And then let's go to Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1. Nehemiah 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of that guy, and it came to pass in the month of Chisleu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the palace, so Nehemiah in the 20th year of a king, that Hananiah, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity, they there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. So this king, he in the 20th year of this king, Nehemiah hears information. And this king happens to be Artaxerxes. In verse 1 of chapter 2, it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. So this Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king. That's why he's bringing him wine, not bringing it to poison him. He was a cupbearer, and it was the 20th year of this king. So Ezra goes back in the 7th year to beautify the temple. Nehemiah is a cupbearer to the king in the 20th year. He hears information, and he actually makes requests to go attend to his brethren back in Jerusalem. So the information he heard was about the walls being broken down. So the only thing you can read about in the book of Ezra is the temple being established and the temple being set up. So Nehemiah gets granted to go back in the first month of that 21st year. And then if you go to chapter 6 of Nehemiah, he goes back. And the whole reason he wanted to go back was God had put it in his heart to rebuild the walls. So, you know, the temple had been rebuilt, but the walls hadn't been. So they still had could have potentially been influenced by the people of the land from attacking them and other things militarily. So Nehemiah wanted to go back and reestablish the walls around the city. And in chapter 6 and verse 15, and the wall was finished in the 20th and 5th day of the month Elu, in the 50 and 2 days. So everybody know what's the month of Elu is, right? So now Nehemiah gets released on the first month of the 21st year. It takes him about, I don't know, 3 to 4 months to travel that 900 miles. He shows up. And then he completes the wall in 52 days. He gets there, he walks around the city for a while, sees the damage, scopes it out, makes a plan, starts initiating the walls, get all the people to join him, completes the walls in 52 days. The month Elu is the 6th month. So it's the 6th month of the 21st year. So from the time he left to the time that the wall had been set up and established, it had been about 5 months. Then the rest of the book of Nehemiah from this point on, almost up until about chapter 12, you know, there's not a whole lot of information that's recorded as to specifically when these things occurred, but we know Nehemiah was doing some things in conjunction with Ezra. Ezra's there as well. Ezra is not just went back to beautify the temple, but Ezra was also a priest as well, or a scribe, and he was reading the law to the people, and you have some feasts that start occurring. So the city has walls now, it's got a temple. And then, remember, Nehemiah was a cupbearer, and he had asked leave from this king Artaxerxes to go back, but he had only requested a certain amount of time. So at some point in time, Nehemiah goes back to the king. Go to chapter 13 in Nehemiah. In verse 6 of chapter 13. But in all this time was not I at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, the king of Babylon, came I unto the king, and after certain days obtained I leave of the king. So from the 20th year to the 32nd year, something happened, and then in the 32nd year, he approaches the king, and he obtained leave from the king to go back to Jerusalem again. So there's a 12-year gap that's hard to trace. There's some things that occur, but nevertheless, then the 32nd year, he leaves the king a second time to go back to Jerusalem, and the rest of this chapter of 13 may potentially have to do with some of the things that happen when he shows back up on the scene. So he had been missing, and when he shows up, there's some things he has to deal with. You know, there are some people living in the temple. There are some that shouldn't be living there. there was some Gentiles living there. There was some, the Levites were being neglected. So if you look at your chart from the beginning of Cyrus's edict in the first year, all the way to the 32nd year of Darius, and then when Nehemiah shows up back up on the scene and deals with some things, could happen anywhere between six months to 24 months. That's 49 years. And you'll look, and I've got the cumulative years. I think it's pink or green depending upon your chart. You'll see the cumulative years span approximately 49 years, which is 7 weeks of years, which was the fulfillment of the prophecy given by Jeremiah, that God told them there would, by Daniel. Daniel read the Jeremiah, and then Daniel got information from Gabriel, the angel, who told him there would be 7 weeks from the going forth of the commandment to the restoration of this city. Then from that time period, from the end of that 7 weeks, would be 62 until the cutting off of the Messiah. So from this point on, up until when Jesus Christ shows up, should have been traceable, you know, should have been that 400 and whatever years. And nevertheless, this is the chronology that we think is there. And there are some things that validate that. We're going to talk about that after the break, of why some of the things that validate that specifically. And we're also going to get into the first six chapters of Ezra specifically to show you in detail a little bit more regarding this man Zerubbabel and some of the things that they had to face and some specific words that we're going to get into regarding those minor prophets Haggai and Zechariah shared with those people. So how long do we want to take?